First, when it comes to the state of U.S. politics, what word would you use to describe what's going on? Polarization? Incivility? According to our next guest, those are too safe. She says hatred, in many cases, would be more accurate. In a piece she wrote in newspapers around the country, she said we finally started to hear that word a few weeks back. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi was asked by a reporter for Sinclair Broadcast Group if the reason she's moving ahead with impeachment is that she hates President Trump.
And as a Catholic, I resent your using the word hate in a sentence that addresses me. I don't hate anyone. I was raised in a way that is full, a heart full of love, and always prayed for the president. And I still pray for the president. I pray for the president all the time. So don't mess with me when it comes to words like that.
Our guest says we seem to be in a state of high conflict, and when high conflict is left unchecked, we get the likes of the Middle East, Northern Ireland, and Sudan. But she says there is a solution. Amanda Ripley is a contributing writer at The Atlantic and a senior fellow at the Emerson Collective. She's the author of The Smartest Kids in the World and How They Got That Way and The Unthinkable, Who Survives When Disaster Strikes and Why. Amanda, good to have you back on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, words like hate and high conflict, you say it's not hyperbole. You see people maybe on both sides of the political spectrum falling more and more into that category.
Well, one of the things I find really frustrating right now in when I read political coverage is that it doesn't talk enough about the psychology. When you get into a really intense us versus them conflict, which is also called high conflict, emotions matter way more than policy or facts or strategy or almost anything else. And so it feels to me like emotions should be part of how we analyze and understand and interpret what is going on politically. So, you know, I think Pelosi is right to recoil at the notion of hatred. And it's interesting to hear the ways in which she tries to keep hatred at bay through prayer. And I think that's a really fascinating conversation, right? Like, is this hatred? Is it not? What are the effects of hatred versus anger, which is much more productive generally than hatred? That to me is like really interesting and helps me understand the world that we're living in, as opposed to continually just going back and forth. You know, he said this, she said this about impeachment or Iran or any other number of conflicts. You need to talk about the emotions that are driving the behavior, which seems so baffling to each side.
It is a different thing to have someone say, I disagree with the people on the other side, but I think they're making a good faith effort. They're just coming to the wrong conclusions, to what you say we're seeing more of these days, which is the other side has nothing to offer. They don't have a valid opinion. I don't need to care what they think.
Right. So we know that about 40% of both Republicans and Democrats say that the other party is not just worse for politics, but that they're downright evil, right? So that's 40% as of 2017. That was research by Nathan Calamo and Liliana Mason. So that's a significant number. That's a change from past years. And so it's important that we talk about what that means. When you think people are inherently evil, you behave very differently than you do when you think people just are misinformed or making mistakes or doing the wrong thing. So that's a really interesting difference in the research between anger, say, and hatred. Aaron Halpern in Israel does some really fascinating research on this, and he's found that, you know, you can make peace agreements and make progress even when there's a lot of anger between different sides. Hatred, though, is very difficult. It tends to make conflict much, much worse and makes it go on much longer because of what you said, that there's a sense that it's immutable, that it can't be changed. Whereas anger says, hey, you're wrong. I'm right. I want to make you see my point of view, and assumes that we're still in some kind of relationship on this earth together.
And it seems like this could be a self-reinforcing loop. If I'm on side A, I'm going to look at those haters on side B who are in that category of people who dismiss side A and they represent all of that side. Then side B is going to look back at my side and so on and so forth. This could keep building on itself.
Exactly. It already is. So it's a sort of perpetual motion machine at this point. And that's what high conflict is. So everything you do to get out of the conflict, say, trying to impeach the president for the Democrats, or for the Republicans trying to convince Democrats, look at the economy, look at all this progress we're making in these different areas. Everything you do to try to convince the other side actually has the effect of making things worse. So that's a signature trait of a high conflict, that things just get worse and worse, and they're kind of on their own momentum. They have their own intelligence, the conflict. So that is a little bit scary, but it's also something that is changeable. You can disrupt high conflict just as you can other kinds of conflict. But you can't keep assuming that times are normal, that we just keep doing everything we always do, and eventually we'll convince each other that we're right.
I want to get to that possible solution in just one moment, but I want to get to maybe the worst case here, that this situation of high conflict, of increasing mutual hatred, could lead to increasing acts of political violence.
Yeah, and I mean, we know this really well from other countries, and we're not different. If anything has become clear to me over the last few years, humans have very much in common when it comes to conflict all over the world. And so we have, in some categories, seen increases in political violence. We can expect to see more political violence as we approach the election and after the election, regardless of the result. Some of that violence will take the form of racial violence, anti-Semitic violence. Some of it will be much more directly political, violence against Republicans, violence against Democrats. And we can expect that, unfortunately, to increase. Now, that doesn't mean we can't do anything, right? But the problem is, once you have violence, it makes everyone frightened and angry and creates more hatred, right? So that leads to more violence. So you get back into that perpetual motion cycle that you were talking about. So there are things that can be done. We know that from experts who do this work in other countries, many of whom have now turned their attention to the United States for all these reasons. But yeah, it is worrisome that, 5 to 15% of both Democrats and Republicans currently say they would support some level of violence against their political opponents. That's not a huge number of people, but it's enough. It's never a majority of people who support sectarian violence. It just takes a few.
Talking to Amanda Ripley, writer and author. She says we're past polarization in American politics. We're veering into hatred, into a state of high conflict. But, she writes, there are some solutions. Amanda, you lay out one suggestion that that you even admit sounds naive, but it seems to work. What is it?
Yeah, I know. It sounds really just ridiculous, but just humor me for one second, because the evidence does support it. So it turns out when Americans read messages, say tweets, calling for peace and condemning political violence, they actually lower their support for political violence. So in other words, we are all influenced by one another. These are cultural norms. They're in flux right now. But when Americans, in the same research by Nathan Calmo and Liliana Mason, when they exposed Americans to a Trump tweet, which is a real treat, a tweet that came out a while ago, which was, "I condemn all types of racism and acts of violence, peace to all Americans." When they expose Americans of different parties to that tweet, the support for political violence goes down. The same is true when they expose Americans to a similar quote from Joe Biden, which his campaign posted after an Antifa attack on a conservative writer last year, in which he said violence directed at anyone because of their political opinions is never acceptable. So these kinds of things would sound so kind of obvious, like of course, are not obvious in this moment. When you get into high conflict, it needs to be said. It needs to be said not just by people in positions of power, but by regular people. And we know from the research that it has a calming effect, that people hear that. And that's good news.
Is it important that people call out not just the other side? It's easy to condemn the other side's act of violence, that people actually are talking to their own side when they make these recommendations for peace?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's much more important that people do this to their own side, because they're, people are not going to trust as much spokespeople from the other side. Yeah, so I think it's, it's something everyone can do. Actually, in this research, which was really cool, even when random strangers called for peace in tweets, Americans in the study also responded well to that. So it doesn't need to be just, political pundits or politicians, although that would be great. And I strongly urge those people to get out ahead of this and condemn political violence right now before the election. But it doesn't need to, we don't need to wait for them, right? Which is the good news. Like, anyone can do this. And, obviously you're going to have more impact on the people people in your circle. And it may feel like something that goes without saying, but that's not actually the case anymore.
We're talking about the politics of polarization, high conflict, and hate in America with Amanda Ripley, contributing writer at The Atlantic and a senior fellow at the Emerson Collective. Her recent piece on hatred in our political system was published in newspapers around the country. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think America's politics are consumed by hate? Do you see this on the rise over the years? What do you see feeding into it? Do you see people giving the kind of messages that Amanda was just talking about, specifically saying, hey, let's not let this bleed over into violence. Let's take a peaceful approach to our politics. Have you done that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now we're talking about American politics, high conflict, and hatred with Amanda Ripley, contributing writer at The Atlantic, senior fellow at the Emerson Collective. Her piece on these topics appeared in the Washington Post and elsewhere. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see this kind of division extending into hatred in America's political scene? Have you experienced it personally? Do you see it on social media, maybe even in person among people? Do you worry about where this could go? What do you see as a solution? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. A lot of comments, Amanda, on the Facebook page there. Kevin writes, social media and the ability to be the keyboard warrior for your cause are two of the reasons we have such a divide. We've lost our ability or our reason to actually have personal interactions with others. Having those personal interactions, Kevin says, would go a long way in people tearing down the walls of hyper-partisanship. What do you think? Is there something about social media and a lack of a personal connection that might be helping drive this?
Yeah, I definitely think there's the effect of anonymity makes it much easier to demonize people, right? We know that from road rage, even before social media. So that's for sure true. Of course, in this research, we could see it works both ways, right? So when you tweet about condemning violence and treating people as complicated individuals rather than immutable evil monsters, then you can have this positive effect. So it is a little complicated in that sense. I would say, though, to Kevin's point, for sure, you know, there are lots of ways to try to combat the rise of hatred. Many, many ways at a collective level, at an individual level. Speaker Pelosi talked about using prayer in her own personal life to try to pray for the president. So instead of hating the president, whether that's true or not, that is definitely one useful strategy. Another is to have relationships with people that you disagree with. And to Kevin's point, we have fewer and fewer of those. People are not marrying or dating across the political divide as they were in my lifetime. These are very unusual times in the sense that people do not know and talk to one another across the political divide. So for me personally, what I do is reporting. Like, I get to go out and talk to people that I disagree with. And when I get to know them, I still disagree with many of the things that they tell me, but I see them as like three-dimensional people, and it makes it much harder to dismiss them en masse and demonize them. It's just as a basic psychological reality is when you know people, it's harder to collapse into simplicity.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Joel is with us in Portage. Joel, hi.
Hello there. I just have a slight disagreement with the way that the author used anger. She described it as, you're wrong and I'm right, and I think that's only part of it. I think it's a common distortion. I think anger is really something like, this is what makes me mad, this is what makes me angry, and here's why. And it's not always the other person. And if we're able to clearly articulate what it is that we're upset about, then it stops being you and me or an us and them thing, and it becomes more ownership by the person really owning what their position is.
Joel, thanks for the call. And Amanda, I think Joel is closer to agreeing with you than he thinks. That's you saw anger as potentially a positive mode of politics, separate from this us and them hatred you're talking about.
Yeah, I like where Joel's going, though. I mean, I think if I'm understanding him right, he's saying that there are ways to do anger that are more or less destructive, right? And so I think that's right. There's a huge spectrum of ways that anger manifests itself given certain conditions. So, yeah, there are ways to do anger that are really productive. And we need conflict. We need anger. Like, this is how we get better as a society or as a family or as a church or a mosque, whatever. Like, we need to be able to disagree. Anger is very mobilizing. Usually anger suggests that there's something underneath. There's some need that's not being met, right? And it's important to probe into that. Like, what is that? It's important for us to do that as a country and also individually. So to me, this is the really interesting part of conflict. And I'm glad we're talking about it because I think, I don't know about everyone else, but I just feel like I'm getting tired of reading news coverage that just goes back and forth like this endless tennis match of vitriol, right? Like, I'm not getting anywhere. Like, I don't feel like I'm learning more about the world or myself or other people. So trying to understand what is the unmet need underneath the anger that we see is maybe more interesting and more productive. But yeah, in general, anger is not a bad thing. Hatred is qualitatively different and tends to be very destructive, right, and can incite violence and other things. So I think it's an important distinction, you know, and one that I think is interesting to talk about out in the open rather than pretending it's not happening.
Joel, thanks a lot for that call. We'll go now to Bridget with us in Green Bay. Bridget, hi.
Hi. So I'm married to a diehard Republican, and I am not. I am of the other persuasion, and it has become much harder over the last 3 years. Even we have become way more entrenched in our beliefs. So we've had to learn to compartmentalize those discussions, and we try really hard to always focus on the things that we love about each other. I always tell my husband one of the things he loves best about me is my bleeding heart. And, you know, it gets tough at times when certain things come up and we've learned to not watch the news together. And, you know, he even has a cousin that is on the national Fox News, has his own show. And so we have to really separate those kinds of things in our life.
And Bridget, you said you've seen it getting harder to do this over the years just because of how politics has changed?
Yeah, over the last 3 years, since the 2016 election, we've both kind of gone off on a different, well, not different, but more entrenched in our own camp, and it's harder for us to see that middle ground. And we've been together between marriage and dating, we've been together 16 years, and these last 3 years have been actually much more polarizing for us than before that. It was never really an issue when we were dating. But it has definitely gotten harder over the last 3 years.
Bridget, thank you so much for sharing that story. Amanda, what do you think about that?
Well, I mean, I think that we need more people like Bridget, basically, and her husband. I mean, I think we know from the research that people who live with people who disagree with them politically tend to have much more complicated and accurate views of the other side. And we know, I did a large project for The Atlantic a while back where we looked at, you know, who are the most politically prejudiced people in the country and the least. And one of the things we found is that people who live with and among people who are from the other political side are much less politically prejudiced, meaning they're less likely to hate the other side. So they disagree, right? And Bridget said that very clearly. Like, they still clearly disagree. And it sounds like it's not easy. And I can believe that. I can believe that. I think there should be free couples counseling for all. This is my platform if I'm running for office. Free couples counseling for everyone who disagrees politically. Because this is actually really, really important because you start to see, oh, hey, actually, as much as I disagree with Republicans on welfare, let's say, I actually know my husband cares about poor people. It's just that he has a very different way of thinking you should help poor people. I'm just making this up, right? Mm-hmm. But like, and vice versa, whereas, you know, her husband appreciates Bridget's, it sounds like appreciates her compassion, her generosity of spirit, right? He thinks that maybe he thinks it's unrealistic, or maybe he thinks it goes too far in certain cases, but he can see that there's a place of good intentions in some of what she's saying, right? So that kind of thing is incredibly valuable in a polarized, high conflict situation like we're living in.
Bridget, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Amanda Ripley about polarization, hatred, and high conflict in American politics. Amanda, I wonder if you have some practical advice for the person who's at their phone or their computer keyboard. They're on social media. They see the comment from their cousin on the other side say they want to respond maybe with some anger, but not go into this this hatred, this high conflict mode. How do we do that?
Yeah, you know, I've been working on that as a reporter as well as a person. And it's one of the things I try to do is to get like super curious. Like, it's not always easy to do. But when I can get really curious, what I find is I can ask questions that reveal things to me that I wouldn't have known otherwise. And the conversation gets a lot more interesting. So, you know, try as much as possible to stay away from like the political talking points and ask about personal stories, like bring it very personal. So maybe you reveal something about your own personal story and ask with genuine curiosity about their story. And that's the hard thing, right, is to get curious, to not assume you know, to not assume all these cascading assumptions we make in conflict, right? So that takes a lot of practice. It's easier in certain situations than others. One of the questions, I have certain questions I keep like on a post-it on my wall in my office for interviews where I feel like we're going down this path of no return and I want to get curious. So I'll ask things like, which a mediation expert named Gary Friedman taught me, the question, what would it be like for you if you got what you wanted on this? Like, what would that look like? And try to get people to talk about not just about what they're against, but like what life would look like for them. And that's not something we talk about very often. We get very dug in on like what's wrong, but it can be a useful way to get people out of those out of the script and into a more interesting place.
Briefly, Amanda, do you have a sense of optimism that we can steer ourselves back out of this high conflict zone?
I think eventually. I mean, we certainly can do it. I don't see it happening soon. Like, I fear that it's going to get worse before it gets better. But I actually have a lot of confidence in most Americans. Like, I think a lot of this is being driven by extremes, by people with the biggest microphones, by people who are extremely partisan. We know that from the research. We know it from all kinds of things. Like I said, it's only 5 to 15% of Americans who endorse political violence against their opponents, right? So the problem is, like, how do we get the microphone back? Like, how do we have regular Americans who I think are mostly exhausted by the vitriol? How do we raise up their voices?
Amanda, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
That's Amanda Ripley. You can keep this conversation about political anger and divide going on the Ideas Network Facebook page. This is Central Time.